Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Good morning, welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there, you can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. You've got Julian Paul here live in the studio as usual. Later in this hour, I'll be talking to RPG. He's chosen a rather interesting track. He wanted Elton John, Rocket Man, which we haven't got, I can't believe. So no. We're having something even more interesting than that.
We did have William Shatner's version of
no,
Rocket Man.
No. normally, we would have a guest speaker every week, but Dr. Ogur Osamor is on his summer recess, and the same goes for Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. He's also on his summer recess. Both will be back with us in September. So you're just going to have to listen to us for half an hour until PG comes on. Loads of stuff in the news this week. Paul, you're first.
Hi, yes. Well, we've been seeing them all the way, everywhere. Butterflies have flocked to Britain for once in a decade. Painted Lady Summer. Warm weather has prompted millions of painted ladies to fly to the UK, with clouds of them seen feeding and mating, and their offspring are now emerging. And we saw butterfly last week, didn't we?
We did, a Red Admiral.
But it's also called Atlanta.
Atlanta, yeah. So we thought we'd found something really, really exotic, but no, it's really common. Talking of which, butterflies, don't forget to take part in the annual UK Big Butterfly Count, which finishes tomorrow, which is Sunday, the 9th of August, 2026. Just in case you're listening on catch-up. Help assess the health of our environment by counting the amount and type of butterflies and dayfly moths you see in a 15-minute period. Just go to www.bigbutterflycount.org. It's very simple to do. And even if you see nothing in that 15-minute period, that's just as important. So there you go.
And also don't forget that this coming Wednesday, 12th of August, there will be a partial solar eclipse early evening, and then later that night a chance to see the Perseid meteor shower. A new moon should mean good viewing if it is a clear sky. Yeah. But most of clear skies have been clear.
I know, but that, if you tuned in last week or go and listen to last week's podcast, Phil Muffett from the Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society talked all about the partial solar eclipse, how to view it safely, importantly. He also talked about the Perseid meteor shower, and it was him who told me about it. It's going to be a new moon, so if it's clear, that's good, because the moon does make it difficult to see the night sky. This next story caught my eye, and I thought, this is really interesting. Bananageddon approaches. Now, what on earth could that be about? So did you know you've probably only ever eaten one variety of banana? And also, every single banana you've eaten is a genetic clone of all the others. I certainly didn't. The bendy yellow Cavendish variety we know and so frequently eat is actually one of hundreds of varieties of bananas. Phi bananas from Polynesia are straight and deep orange. Javanese bananas are blue and taste like custard. Sounds good to me. But the Cavendish banana dominates the global market because its thick skin and slow ripening process make it suited to the demands of international trade. However, it is now in peril, threatened by a fungus called Panama disease. All very interesting, eh? So, Paul, next.
Yes, elsewhere in the news, in the Finnish town of Pornainen, that's P-O-R-N-A-I-N-E-N, an hour north of Helsinki, engineers have built a giant sand battery. Sand is abundant, cheap, and is very effective at retaining heat. The large insulated silo, which measures 30 metres tall, holds enough sand to store 100 megawatts of thermal heat, enough to power the entire town of 5,000 people for a week in winter or a month in summer.
Interesting. Ooh. Meanwhile, Hungary has been forced to shut down its nuclear plant, its only nuclear plant, which generates 40% of the country's electricity, due to a record-breaking drought in Central Europe. Dropping water levels in the Danube, which the station uses for cooling, force a suspension of power generation.
And whilst you may know Beatrix Potter for her children's stories, she was also a serious student of fungi. She produced more than 250 paintings and drawings of fungi at a time when these organisms were still poorly understood. Her illustrations remain beautiful works of art, but they also show how the best natural history drawings make us notice things we might otherwise miss.
Another really interesting story. According to a new study by Oxford University researchers published in the Royal Society Open Science Journal, organic free-range eggs are worst for the environment.
No.
The report concluded that, whilst they may be better in terms of welfare, organic free-range eggs come with higher emissions and water pollution than eggs from caged hens. So that's an interesting bit of research.
You cannot. Next, hiker John Scott, 65, has this week reached the end of a 2,300-mile trek linking all 15 national parks of Great Britain. This is set to become a new internationally recognised route, the Slowways National Parks Trail, starting in Cromer, Norfolk, and ending in Nairn, Scotland, having woven back and forth across Britain.
Yeah, and finally, this section of the Science News Update. If you tuned in last week, as I said, you would have heard Phil Muffett from Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society talk not only about the partial solar eclipse coming up this Wednesday and the Perseid meteor shower, but we also talked about the shock potential closure of Jodrell Bank. Well, this week, more than 150 public figures have signed a letter calling for the government to reverse their decision and find funding immediately to save Jodrell Bank. About £2.8 million has been pulled from the Cheshire Observatory, leaving the University of Manchester needing to find alternative cash by 2028. Signatories to the letter include astronaut Tim Peake, musician Sir Brian May, Jarvis Cocker, our very own Sheffield Jarvis Cocker, and Johnny Marr from the Smiths, no less. Scotland's Astronomer Royal, Professor Catherine Haymans, also signed, as did physicist Professor Jim Al-Khalili and Professor Brian Cox, and Judy Spence, the daughter of the site's founder, Sir Bernard Lovell, also signed that letter. The UK research and Innovation Agency, or UKRI, has said it has to focus on projects that delivered the greatest long-term impact. The observatory, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, is dominated by the enormous Lovell Telescope, a structure that was voted Britain's greatest unsung landmark back in 2006. All scientific observations at Jodrell Bank are expected to cease on the 1st of April 2028 unless alternative funding can be found. 28 jobs are at risk at the observatory, but its closure would also affect the work of nearly 3,000 scientists who use it in their research.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
8, 7.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2.
Check ignition,
1.
And may God's love
lift
be
off
with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way, and the stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can.
Oh, Space Oddity there by David Bowie from 1969. Ouch. Because we were talking about the potential closure of Jodrell Bank. Let's see what happens. Of course, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're here every Saturday morning live from 11 until 12 talking about science in all its different forms. Next up, I'm going to talk about blue bins in Sheffield. Ooh, some of you might have already got your new blue bin. We certainly have. And with it comes a leaflet. If you haven't got one yet, they're being rolled out across the city over the next few months. So once you get your blue bin, why have we got another one? Well, to make it easier to recycle your paper and card, you now have a new larger blue bin, which is the same size as your brown bin. So why have people receiving a new larger blue bin? Well, 78% of the smaller blue bins were full on collection day, and satisfaction surveys repeatedly told the council people wanted a larger blue bin. Also, new rules mean the council has to maximise recycling, so that the new larger blue bin provides more space for recycling your paper and card. And it's got a larger opening, so it makes it easier to recycle large cardboard. They say, please ensure all paper and cardboard is clean and dry before your you put it in your blue bin. And when you get a new blue bin, it says bin day collection has not changed. Now, you can keep hold of your old blue bin if you want to, or they will take it away. So what happens when your recycling bins are collected? I thought this was an interesting bit of information anyway. So every 4 weeks, your blue bin is collected by our crews, and also every 4 weeks, your brown bin is collected by our crews. So what happens with the recycling? So your blue bin is for paper and card. This includes any paper, newspapers, pamphlets and cardboard. Do not put any other materials into your blue bin. So once it's collected, your paper and card is taken to Baton Materials Recovery Facility, where it is separated into three categories: cardboard, mixed paper and newspapers and pamphlets. The material is then sent on to reprocessors to be made into new paper and card items. Your brown bin is for mixed recycling. This includes any glass bottles, jars, food and drink cartons, foil and foil trays, plastic bottles, pots, tubs, trays and tubes and drinks, cans, food tins and aerosols. As again, don't put any other materials into your brown bin. Your mixed recycling is sent to Tinsley Transfer Station, where it is bulked for transportation. The material is then sent on to a materials recovery facility in Derbyshire. Here it is separated and sorted into different groups by operatives and a range of different machines. Each material group is then baled separately and sent on to reprocess to be made into new items. So in your brown bin, you can now recycle all of these materials: plastic bottles, pots, tubes, trays and tubes, tins, cans, aerosols and clean foil, glass bottles, jars, food, drink, cartons and Tetra Pak, which you certainly couldn't before. Interestingly, with this leaflet, it asks you if you need an additional brown bin. Oh, with more items being accepted in your brown bin, you may find you need another one. So an additional brown bin will be available in the new year. You can scan the QR code if you've got the leaflet, or just go onto the council's website to register your interest. So I thought that was a fantastic bit of information about recycling from Veolia, from Sheffield City Council. So if you haven't got your blue bin yet, keep your eye out for it.
Yo, listen up, here's the story about a little guy that lives in a blue world. And all day and all night and everything he sees is just blue, like him inside and outside. Blue his house with a blue little window and a blue Corvette. And everything is blue for him and himself and everybody around, 'cause he ain't got nobody to listen to.
I'm blue, da ba dee da ba die, 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 da ba dee da ba die. I'm blue. We'll be right back.
by the streets and all the trees are too. I have a girlfriend and she is so blue. Blue are the people here that walk around.
What a great track, eh?
That's a great hit, that, wasn't it?
Eiffel 65, I think that was a hit in 15 countries.
It was.
Blue, dabba-dee. Why did we play that? I know. Why did we play that? We're talking about the new blue bins in Sheffield. You're listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, of course. Next up, a little snippet from our Chris. He's our regular guest speaker on the fourth Saturday of the month. There was something in on the BBC News this morning about why have obesity rates doubled since 1993? Well, Chris has all the answers, but the BBC also talks about it as well. So, if England's obesity rates were still the same as 1993, there would be 7 million fewer adults living with obesity. There are 14 million adults classified as obese, despite successive governments launching 14 separate obesity strategies over the past three decades. It's clear something isn't working. According to new analysis by the King's Fund, 15% of England's adult population, those aged 16 and over basically, in 1993 was obese, with rates achieving a record high of 30% in 2024. The analysis by the King's Fund suggests obesity rates are rising fastest in the 16 to 24 year olds age bracket, with 18% classified as obese or severely obese in 2024, compared with just 6% in 1993. Accounting for population change, this means there are now 1 million young adults living with obesity in England, 700,000 more than if rates had not risen over the past three decades. So let's see what's it all about then. What are the experts saying? Why has obesity risen? Well, there were several factors behind the rise in obesity, including changes in eating habits and food prices over the last 30 years. Service industry or white-collar jobs take a larger share of the economy, and there has been a decline in traditional manufacturing and other blue-collar work, such as manual labour. This means people are more sedentary, they're basically doing office jobs, and they're sat down a lot more and not moving around. Food prices have also fallen since the 1990s, partly because of increased competition between the major supermarkets, alongside an increase in fast food outlets and home delivery. All sounds familiar, doesn't it? If you're tuning regularly to this programme, you'll hear Chris Dale talk about the impact of ultra-processed foods on our health and our weight. With things like deliveries, it's very easy and convenient now to click a button and you get a takeaway at your door. We're making it much easier, therefore, as a society to have high-fat, high-salt and high-sugar foods. Generally, ultra-processed foods have all three of those, and that's something you wouldn't find in nature, the hyper-palatable foods. Takeaways high in fats, salt and sugar are more widely available in areas high deprivation, where people are at higher risk of obesity. It's interesting as well that in those areas that are more deprived, people are willing to spend quite a big share of their income on fast food. And also less healthy food in supermarkets are also cheaper than they were decades ago, while there have been several cost of living crises in recent years. It's interesting because in a recent review national press about what snacks and things are good for you and what supermarks are selling what, Marks and Spencer's has pretty much upped their game, and it rates a lot of their snacks on the go and things like that. They're really, really good for you. They're getting 5 out of 5 with no additives. They're high in protein. They've got vegetables, blah, blah, blah. So it's things are changing. So obesity can be a risk factor for several chronic conditions, including type 2 diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, osteoarthritis, and some cancers. And some reports estimate obesity and being overweight costs the UK economy approximately £126 billion a year, including £12 billion to the NHS, roughly 7% of its annual budget. Since 1992, the year before data on obesity in England was first collected, 14 national obesity strategies have been published. All very interesting. So what we're going to do about it? It's an interesting one. We're not sure. Oh, wait, they're changing, trying to change laws on the sale of unhealthy food items, sugar tax, fat tax maybe, and there's basically the school dinners are going to be reviewed as well. I think this is something that starts in September this year, won't come into force until the following year, new guidelines for schools. All interesting stuff, I'm sure. Our Chris will talk about that a lot more, or something related to that on a future show. The other issue also is reading a lot about in the press, which I won't cover here, is the fat jabs and now the fat pill. I think it's estimated it's a growing number of people on those. I think once you're on them, you've got to stay on them. I think the pill's £100 a month, which maybe you can't afford it. But at the end of the line, doctors and researchers and scientists are saying the best way to lose weight is to eat a balanced diet and to exercise. And there's no substitute for that, even though it might seem like a quick win. Anyway, before we talk to RPG, another fantastic story in the news, and there is a fantastic track coming up as well, which we almost played by accident earlier on. Never mind. I saw this in the on the news on the 5th of August, which I think was a Wednesday this week. Sharpest ever pictures of the sun. So scientists using the world's most powerful solar telescope have captured the surface of our sun in new unprecedented detail. Images and footage show whirlpools of activity that it has not been possible to see before. It is the sun's magnetic field being twisted and moved by the motion of hot gas. That constant swirling is a driving force behind bursts of energy from the sun, creating so-called space weather that can disrupt Earth's power grids and satellites and could even injure astronauts. The United States National Solar Observatory, or USNSO, explained that the sun is the source of that energy and of all that space weather. So capturing more detailed pictures of the sun will help scientists respond to that weather, that space weather. To figure out and eventually predict space weather, the USNSO need to understand the physics of the sun all the way down to the smallest scales. At extreme close-up of the surface of the sun, which has been captured by the world's most powerful solar telescope, shows a fiery orange glow with patterns that look almost like etchings of leaves across the surface. These patterns are evidence of swirls of instability on the sun's surface. These are the highest resolution images of the sun's surface or photosphere that have ever been captured. The findings published in the journal Nature were made possible by the INOUE solar telescope. That's INOUYE. I'm sure I pronounced that incorrectly, but it's the solar telescope, a facility built on a high peak in Hawaii where clear blue skies are free of dust. Zooming in on the sun's surface, the team captured a detailed view of swirling vortices. So the United States National Solar Observatory astronomer Dr. David Kuradich said these twisting motions are creating magnetic energy which can build up to produce those large-scale explosions. Another image shows the fiery orange surface of the sun with an ejection of what looks like an arc of flames protruding from the surface. This is a coronal mass ejection, a sudden blast of solar plasma and magnetic fields that the sun sends into space. Scientists say they have captured the driving force behind sudden blasts of solar plasma and magnetic fields that the sun sends into space. The term for what the scientists have discovered on the sun is referred to as Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. Interesting. So this phenomenon happens when fluids, in this case hot gases, slide past each other and cause small disturbances to grow into spiraling vortices. In the ocean, it helps explain how ripples become giant powerful waves. So Dr. Friedrich Roger, also from the United States National Solar Observatory, explained that finding it on the sun's surface not only explained the dynamics behind space weather, but even why the surface of the sun is so hot. It shows how energy is transported upwards, because once there is enough energy wound up in the higher layers, it can then be released as a flare or what is known as a coronal mass ejection. The United States National Solar Observatory also said, and I found this very interesting, said that the new findings were a reminder that the sun is a unique laboratory. It's our closest star and it can help us understand some very basic laws of physics. In fact, the first experimental proof of Einstein's theory of general relativity came from solar eclipse observations. There you go. Thank you. Some fantastic sounds in there. Set the Controls to the Heart of the Sun. That's a fantastic track there by Pink Floyd, of course, 1968. And we played that because we were talking about sharpest ever pictures of the sun. And also a reminder as well that this coming Wednesday, the 12th of August, there will be a partial solar eclipse early evening. And then later that night, a chance to see the Perseid meteor shower. Because there should be a new moon, should be good viewing. That's if it's a clear sky, all good stuff. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Life Science Radio Show, of course, here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. On digital, if you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org. We're every Saturday morning from 11 until 12, talking about science in all its different forms. We should have PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning. On Cat Day, International Cat Day or something.
Yeah, little bird whispered in my ear that it's International Cat's Day, and my cat never said a word.
Did it not? So you've not made a fuss of it then? Bought it some new collar or something like that?
We always make a fuss of it, I guess, so that
it's spoiled then. Yeah, spoiled as usual. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Oh, some of the highs and lows, I guess, of what's been happening in the science world. I think we've sort of looked at another beautiful sunny day today here, and it's causing all sorts of problems with things like the crops. So a lot of farmers are saying that if they don't get some rain in short order, then a lot of crops are going to be a lot less productive or are going to die altogether. Add that to the sort of fires that have been starting because of the dryness everywhere, and farmers have been pitching in and trying to make fire breaks to protect some of their crops, but again there's a lot of losses of crops for the fires and also through the lack of water. So I was watching a piece on Sky News this morning about the river levels falling, and it's impacting on some of the leisure things like paddleboarding and floating, because the rivers are down to zero level in some areas, in some parts of rivers. So it gets really sort of quite difficult. But good old Sheffield University had some news about potentially one of the ways that we can get by in difficult times. And that's a story about the world's deepest underground farm. And they say that that could reshape UK food production. And I think if we've spoken about before I think in London there are several places that commercially produce what they call micro herbs for restaurants and catering. They also produce salad produce. So lettuce is quite often produced in sort of controlled environment where they use LED light in controlled temperature and humidity and water to produce very clean, fresh crops that they can actually deliver, as they say, as micro herbs to do fine dining with and things. So this initiative from the University of Sheffield is in conjunction with an urban farming, vertical farming. And vertical farming is where they plant, rather than horizontally across a field, they plant vertically. So you'll see it appearing in a lot of urban environments where the side of a building, the walls, will be covered in green vegetation, and it's vertical farming. And what the university have done is to take that to new depths. So crops are being planted just over a kilometre underground in a working mine. So it's the launch of the world's deepest vertical farm. It's a study led by the University of Sheffield and an organisation called Farm Urban. And they aim to gather the first real-world evidence of whether underground farming could be commercially viable. So they hope the mine's stable environment, existing infrastructure, will significantly reduce the high energy costs associated with conventional vertical farming. So they say that could transform disused UK mines into sustainable food hubs, creating jobs and improving access to fresh produce in economically deprived areas. So great bit of work going on. So the partnership with Farm Urban is to test the viability of growing crops in unique subterranean conditions. Now, Farm Urban as an organisation also look at lots of other areas like the ones I mentioned about growing microherbs and things above ground. But this is the sort of leading test between the two organisations. So at the centre of the project is the Science and Technology Facilities Council, and it's the Boulby Underground Laboratory. So it's located in a working polyhalite and salt mine near Whitby. And using the site's naturally stable environment, and you find that quite a lot in salt mining, that it's a very consistent environment, stable temperatures, and it's already got existing infrastructure to carry things like lighting and ventilation. So the researchers hope that by reducing the higher energy costs associated with conventional above ground vertical farming, that this could be a way forward. So it's been expanding rapidly in recent years, vertical farming, but this is the first time that crops will be tested at such extreme. It's a 12-month study designed to move beyond theory and provide the first real-world evidence of whether underground farming is a practical and profitable way to grow food. Jacob Nichols, who's the co-lead on the Institute of Sustainable Foods Control Environment Agriculture Group at the University of Sheffield, said the idea of underground farming is not new. However, there's very little real-world evidence to show how it could work. So that's what this is all about, is to test and see if they can build a robust model and understand the opportunities that some of these underground sites use and validate and provide practical data towards that. So sort of take us off the surface and say more than a metre below ground to do vertical farming. And I think it's a flag that I think Science Minister Lord Valence, whose name you may remember from COVID times because he was often speaking, he says the government backs science because of its power to tackle the most important challenges affecting us all. and growing fresh food while using less energy and land and being less reliant on the changeable British weather could strengthen food security across our country and protect our environment. So it's a great way for scientists and technologists to help to use these environments to strengthen our non-reliance on just the surface grown food. It's made possible through the UK Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council. They've given some access funding through the Bioscience Partnerships Award, and they'll work closely with the laboratory staff to give access to both the unique environment and the breadth of engagement experienced. So very interesting sort of science going to the depths, I think. One of the things that really sort of caught my eye in the news, and again, a great local connection with Sheffield University. And they say it reflects the commitment to independent thinking and shared ambition, demonstrating how creative minds at Sheffield are shaping solutions to global challenges. And we've seen lots of work from the university about growing sort of more drought-resistant crops, so trialling the different wheat strains and different plantings to take the advantage of what we have in terms of environment, because it's looking like the climate change that's been flagged for such a long time is steadily creeping in, and we're seeing much more apparent things. And I guess the time scale is for a comparable sort of period. We were looking back to 1976 for the UK.
Yeah.
So it's quite a long cycle, but certainly the weather conditions, from my experience, are comparable, if not beyond what we experienced in 1976. So great news that the university are continuing work, and a strange thing to think about growing fresh produce a kilometre down a mine.
Underground, and with LED lights instead of sun. There you go.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It means you can grow year-round. But on that note, Paul, I'll just mention this because we bought some strawberries from Marks and Spencer's, and I always look on the label to see where they're from, because sometimes they're from Scotland, sometimes from Norfolk. Well, it said Dyson Farms, Lincolnshire. And I thought, I vaguely remember something in the press about James Dyson actually being related to him. And it is. He owns this Dyson Farming, which is headquartered in Lincolnshire, and it says it's using, it spans 36,000 acres and is using innovative renewable energy, cutting-edge technology. But the strawberries, he says, they're using rotating vertical structures for strawberries and aeroponic fog systems for soil-free seed potato production to drastically reduce water and energy use. And so you just by looking at a label, Dyson Farming, I thought it can't be the James Dyson, you know, think of Hoover Man, and there he is.
No, it's also an extensive use of robotics, mechanisation. So as you say, the strawberries are grown in hoppers that rotate. They've got the control lighting and ventilation for production. So this is, again, a scientific approach to increasing the production of food and isolating it from environmental shifts.
Yeah, it's amazing. So aeroponics, I've had to Google this now, Paul, I'll admit it.
Yep.
Modern way to grow plants without soil. Plant roots hang in the air inside a dark chamber and get sprayed or misted with water and plant food.
Yep.
There you go. So, you know, the world is changing, but people like James Dyson, and the universities and all the research centres, we've got to be on it, because food security and sustainability, we hardly grow any of us food. It's a very small proportion, isn't it?
Well, I think, again, if you want a timely sort of look, in the Second World War, we had a massive shift of the use of land to make us more self-sufficient than we were. as a country, we still massively rely on importing our sort of staple foodstuffs. And if you look again, it was the growth of things like allotments. And if you see, there's a kind of a rebirth in use of allotments from people who want to grow things like their own vegetables. But it's actually a small thing that's growing back where it used to be a very large and widespread thing. I know I sort of used to go through Freshville quite a lot in the past, and there was a little close off one of the roads, which was for elderly people. There were small houses that were built for elderly people. And in the centre of that was a patch of garden, a communal garden. And they used to grow and garden between themselves and hand out the produce to pensioners and people who live there. And since the time I remember that, it's now been repopulated with not people of pensionable age. The patch of land that was a productive garden for all the people there has become a parking lot. it's really people think more about parking their car.
Sounds like a Joni Mitchell song, that, Paul.
That, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't know what you've got till it's gone.
Yeah, absolutely. Like a lot of things, I think that... I don't know. I feel that people have got to take some responsibility back, and sometimes that's very difficult. Whereas other times, as I say, we've spoken to people like Regather on the station before, and Regather used to go out and go alongside things like the railway tracks, because surprisingly enough, there's a huge amount of fruit that's grown. And I was driving along one of the roads leading to Bockham Parkway, and I saw people there gathering from the hedgerow, sort of food. So there's an awful lot of food that goes to waste. I think, I forget the number now, but in terms of food that's purchased and then gone to waste, there's a huge percentage of wastage in UK currently. So again, some of the food banks are trying to get that food before it's thrown into waste bins and create food with it, create cafes and provide meals for people. But it's people just grabbing a slight sort of hold on that and trying to produce something that would have gone to waste.
Exactly. So. Top tip as well. If you're going to pick blackberries or apples or anything, the ones that are south-facing will be sweeter.
And you need to get them now because they're about three weeks.
Well, they're way ahead, aren't they?
And the apples are falling off the trees.
The apples are falling.
Yeah, there is free produce there for people. So it's great that an organisation like Regather used to put it up, but just on a micro thing, I got an elder in the bottom end of my garden, which produces elderberries, and a chap used to come round and ask if I minded him collecting the elderberries, and that used to produce a couple of bottles of elderberry wine for me.
Mm.
So it can be very sort of useful.
We're very lucky because my uncle, he's not got a very big garden, but he's always grown his own veg and fruit, and he's done he always does incredibly well with onions, but he said they've been small this year, even though he's watered them. And I think this is what you talked about at the start of it, about farmers saying, hey, the crops aren't as productive, and you're going to get smaller produce.
Yes. I think it is, and I think, again, because of the thing, what I've noticed is vegetables, it's a real sort of difficult balance to either use refrigeration to keep them fresh, because if you leave them out for what would have been not very long, you suddenly find out they're starting to rot.
I know. My uncle's grown loads of potatoes this year, and they're still. He won't lift them because he said they've not flowered, but he thinks he's going to lift them and there's going to be nothing there.
Yeah, I think it was. When we were having all the rain, if you notice, when you bought your potatoes, they were full of water.
Yes.
And now if you...
They're rock hard, aren't they? Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. That climate shift, so...
But it's important that people start to think about this, because, you, as you say, we do import a lot of food, but the thing is now in this country, our climate in this country now is more able to grow vines and olives and things we wouldn't have dreamed of being able to buy or to grow.
We talked about the sort of northward movement of wine sort of growing and production. So grapes have gone sort of up towards York, I think, now.
Definitely.
The kind of northern limit. And here in Sheffield, we get some wine production in limited amounts.
Holmfirth as well.
Holmfirth, yeah, that's got a vineyard. It's amazing, isn't it?
Well, I think it is, and I think some of it is, you know, there's terrible sort of stats coming out about younger people not being able to cook a meal, not having the skills imparted anymore because they've become so much part of the sort of delivery of ready meals. And some research has just come out about obesity, which says that currently, it's 16 to 24-year-olds are still increasing the number of obese people in that group. So overall figures for obesity are going up within the country. So what they say, it's very, very difficult to pin down what exactly it is, and it's a combination of things, I think, lifestyle changes, but also, as Chris has been on and talked about, you know, the industrialisation of food production.
Mm. We're not eating food, we're eating chemicals.
Mm. Absolutely, and how do people know about it? And the article I read about that says that successive governments, I think Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, David Cameron, have all introduced things like sort of food advertising of certain types before 9 p.m. Sort of watershed. They've sort of put the sugar tax on. That was a Conservative government put sugar tax on drinks. And there is a reaction initially which says they start to take sugar out, but then you start to find out that the substitution that they make to keep it...
Yeah, is even worse for you than sugar.
Yeah, so it's very difficult. And I think that kind of took me through the lows in science, I guess, but actually aspirations to get away from some of the lows that we've got to looking towards space.
Oh.
And the story about a part of a rocket that went rogue in space, and this was a Falcon 9 rocket stage that has... Falcon 9's one of the new SpaceX rockets that the first bit that boosts the booster stage can actually come back to Earth and be recollected and reused. So I think there is sort of between 300 and 400 launches are using that system have sort of gone forward. It's a very tall rocket. The payload, when it's launched, is covered by a protective cover, which is ejected early on once it's into space. So you get that, but the booster stage falls away and comes back to Earth. The second stage then is about 4 tons in weight, and that's left in space and should sort of come back in and burn up or be potentially be able to be recovered. But this is a thing that they've given some sort of credence to the some movements on the magnetic field actually shifted the orbit of this stage. So 4 tons of rockets suddenly took off on trajectory heading towards the moon. And in a recent week or so ago, it actually arrived at the moon, doing something like 5 to 6 thousand miles an hour. They said the event didn't really create a great visual effect for any amateur astronomers to be able to see, but the aftermath has been sort of seen by some of the newer telescopes that are around. So I think talking about Jodrell Bank, that around the first moon missions sort of made its name, I think, as being part of the way to be able to report and keep track of what happened on the moon. So in recent week, we got 4 tons of material slamming into the moon, which is luckily seems to be okay. It's created quite a noticeable little crater, little crater on the moon, and that is viewable by people. But it's one of those things, even the best laid plans sometimes will go astray. And apart from the same organization, I think, sending a Tesla car flying off into space, which is still heading somewhere. this was one that they didn't mean to happen, and a sizable piece. And what the article that I saw on this said is that there's sort of over 3,000 man-made objects now scattered over the surface of the moon. So if you think about the probes that have landed or partially landed or sort of mishit, then that's really what's happening with the moon. And we are trying to create that as a jump station to move further into deep space. So maybe the junk on the moon could contribute towards building some kind of an environment to take us out into the depths of space.
Indeed. And on that note, we've just got time to play a little bit of a track called Blood and Rockets by the Claypool Lennon Delirium. And the Lennon in this instance is Sean Lennon. Good. Ooh, bye-bye, Paul. We'll speak on Monday. Glory's Rock Show. One, two, three. Bye-bye. Bye.